Well, good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here. How's this? Good morning. Yes, that works better. Okay, I'll just have to remember to shout. Okay, I'm going to have to cave, and how's this? Is that better? Not really. Okay, I'm gonna try to talk much louder. Good morning. Just right on it. Okay. So I'm finding it really challenging to keep the volume up, and the panel found it very challenging to try to explain this really wide array of seemingly disparate findings. So I'm going to give you some highlights from our discussions of the factors that seemed to be worth considering as explanations. So we asked three questions about each factor. First, does the factor influence health? Is there good reason to believe it influences health? Second, does the factor differ between the U.S. and the peer countries? And third, do those differences plausibly explain the U.S. health disadvantage? I want to make it clear that we did not reach definitive conclusions. We could only identify plausible explanations. And now the obligatory slide on disclosures, which I have none. So medical care was clearly a logical place to start. We are the only one of the peer countries to lack universal financial access to medical care. So lack of access could explain some forms of worse health among those without insurance. But studies have shown a U.S. health disadvantage even among those who have insurance. Now, that might be explained by inadequate insurance or by our fragmented, specialist-oriented medical care system. Thank you very much for that. Our specialist-oriented medical system with weak primary care. But we judge that medical care deficits as a whole could not explain the U.S.'s worse health on many conditions that are not primarily influenced by medical care, including the prevalence of diabetes and obesity, the incidence of injury, including gun violence, homicide, and traffic fatalities, and the incidence of sexually transmitted infections, HIV, AIDS, low birth weight, and preterm birth. Obesity was another likely suspect given that we have the highest rates. It's obviously a strong risk factor for chronic disease, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and arthritis, so a likely contributor to the U.S. health disadvantage in adulthood. But obesity is not likely to be a major factor in the incidence of low birth weight, preterm birth, HIV, STIs, or intentional injury, for example. Furthermore, studies have found the U.S. health disadvantage even when studying only people of normal weight. So what about behaviors? On average, we have worse... I'm glad you like the picture, Dev. My colleagues helped me pick that one. So on average, we have worse diets, we're more sedentary, and these could contribute to our greater burden of chronic disease. But as I just noted, the U.S. health disadvantage has been seen among people of normal weight. Behaviors undoubtedly explain our greater rates of alcohol and drug-related deaths, but the health disadvantage has been shown among non-drinkers. We're more likely to have unprotected sex, to drive without our seatbelts on, and to own and use guns. These could respectively help explain higher rates of HIV, STIs, traffic fatalities, and our higher rates of firearm injuries and homicide. Poverty, especially child poverty, can have a profound, enduring adverse health effect. Since the 1980s, we've had the highest rates of overall poverty and child poverty among the peer countries, which could be a very important factor in our health disadvantage before age 50. But it cannot explain all of the findings because studies have found the U.S. health disadvantage even when examining only affluent people, which Steve noted. This chart just shows you where we rank among the 17 peer countries on the percentage of children who are living in poverty. We have the highest rate. Since the 1980s, we've had higher levels of income inequality than most of our peers. Economic inequality has repeatedly been associated with the health of populations. There are ongoing debates about whether the link is causal or not, but it is plausible that living in an unequal society could damage the health of everyone, not only the poor, partly through effects, corrosive effects on social cohesion and solidarity. We used to be called the land of opportunity, but now several other countries have a greater likelihood that someone born into poverty will escape from poverty by adulthood. We concluded that economic inequality and immobility and or their underlying causes could significantly contribute to the U.S. health disadvantage across the life course. One facet of social inequality is incarceration. We have by far the highest rates of incarceration. This reflects an extreme degree of social disadvantage, of exclusion, and of marginalization. And it affects not only the prisoners, but their families and their communities. The heaviest burden is on African Americans. The total health impact of the U.S.'s policies on incarceration should not be underestimated. We are, as Steve remarked, we're more ethnically diverse than our peers, and we have very large racial inequities in the social determinants of health, adversely affecting the health of people of color. But this can't explain the U.S. health disadvantage overall, because the disadvantage has been seen when studying only non-Latino whites. Furthermore, immigrants are generally healthier than the U.S.-born. We not only lack universal financial access to medical care, but in general, our safety nets are weaker and they have bigger holes than the peer countries. For example, safety nets for unemployment and disability, for sick leave, for maternity and parental leave, and for childcare. We have relatively low spending on family and children's services, public health, and social services relative to our peer countries. Now, social safety nets may not be very important to the very richest people. It looks like that just advanced. Okay, that just advanced quite a few. The social safety nets may not be very important to the very richest people, the top 1%, but there is reason to believe that they could be very important not only to the poor, but to virtually almost all of the rest of the population. For example, the lack of public child care and lack of public preschool places a very heavy financial burden on many middle-class families. Segments of the middle class may perhaps rarely use some of the safety nets, but knowing that they are there if needed could reduce chronic stress, which is strongly linked with health. So weak safety nets could be an important contributor to our health disadvantage. We have a very high rate and an increasing rate of children growing up in single-parent households. They are more likely to be poor, and they have more health risks. However, Sweden, France, and Denmark have even higher rates of single-parent families, but generally better health. Denmark doesn't do as well as Sweden and France, but it is better than us on a number of measures. And this suggests that with appropriate societal supports, perhaps the outcomes of single-parent families need not be so adverse. In the U.S., the combination of high rates of single-parent households with a lack of public services and supports may contribute to the U.S. health disadvantage across the life course. It could cause stress among the single parents, with later health consequences for them, and it could have health consequences among the children, manifesting in their childhood, their adolescence, or their early adulthood, early or mid-adulthood. However, single parenting in the U.S. has become increasingly linked with poverty, so this could not explain the U.S. health disadvantage among the affluent. Only two peer countries have a lower percentage of children in preschool. We also have a low percentage of children under 2 years of age in formal daycare. A massive body of evidence has shown that high-quality early childhood education can have beneficial effects on physical, cognitive, and emotional development, each of which predicts adult educational attainment, economic well-being, and thus health across the life course. The benefits have been demonstrated for children across the socioeconomic spectrum, but they are particularly profound for disadvantaged children. We concluded that our low rates of participation in early childhood education could be an important contributor to our health disadvantage below age 50. This just shows you the percentage of each country's GDP devoted to public expenditures on early childhood education. We spend less than 9 peer countries. Now, considering education overall and primary, secondary, tertiary education, we know that education powerfully influences health through multiple pathways. The effects are lagged. The picture is mixed regarding the U.S.'s relative standing on education. But we have, on some measures, we do about middling, but we have poor or mediocre performance compared with our peers on standardized tests of academic achievement at age 15, and we seem to be slipping behind on a number of measures. So we considered the role of stress and how several of the factors just discussed could affect health. For example, the stress of being able to afford medical care or good child care, the stress of being a single parent, or of experiencing or perhaps just fearing financial hardship in the absence of adequate safety nets. Work-family balance may be more strained in the U.S. Racism-related stress could compound the effects of other stressors for people of color. Although there's much to be learned, we now know that chronic stress and deprivation, particularly in childhood, can have physiologic effects that persist for a long time, and they may be irreversible in some cases. A number of biological mechanisms have been identified, including the HPA axis, the sympathetic nervous system, vascular effects, immune functioning, inflammation, as well as effects on telomeres, the caps at the ends of chromosomes. Stressful environments can lead to epigenetic changes. We concluded that stress is a plausible mediator of many aspects of the U.S. health disadvantage across all racial ethnic groups and across virtually all socioeconomic groups. So I couldn't resist sharing this one with you because I think it... Don't you think it captures our approach to helping people with stress? So this is our alternative to social protections. So many of you may recall learning about Occam's razor in a science class or a philosophy class. Sir William of Occam, the medieval philosopher whose picture here, he's credited with hypothesizing that if one could choose between a simple explanation for a phenomenon and a more complex one with multiple disparate explanations required, all other things being equal, one should opt for the simplest explanation. So in other words, one should take a razor and whittle down the multiple explanations to the simplest. But after reviewing all the evidence, we concluded that no single factor could explain the range of findings that we had, and that multiple social factors were undoubtedly operating. So using Occam's razor, we felt compelled to seek an underlying unifying theme that might account for all of the seemingly disparate but plausible contributing factors. So the unifying theme that we came up with is the following: a deeply rooted culture and values that prize individualism, individual freedom, and the survival of the most fortunate over social solidarity. Steve did tell you to take antidepressants at the beginning of the session, so I hope they're kicking in by now. This could potentially explain all of the factors cited above, including our behaviors, the poverty, the inequality, the immobility, the lack of early childhood education, and the weak safety nets, and the policies that shape all of these factors, which in turn could explain and in some cases reflect the stress. So up to now, I've stayed pretty close to the report, and I'm going to take a liberty now in my final remarks to editorialize a little and express some personal views that do not necessarily reflect those of the entire panel and probably would not have made it through IOM clearance. So as we were concluding our deliberations, we were asked to think of good titles for the report. And someone on the panel had the following suggestion. I don't remember who it was. That's probably good. So what they said was this: You know, the state of New Hampshire's motto, every state has a state motto. The state of New Hampshire's motto is live free or die. Okay. So the suggestion was that we should call the report live free and die. So live free, free of high taxes, free of much responsibility to help others, free of many regulations on individuals and corporations that could protect or promote health, free to skip using seatbelts when we don't feel like using them, free to have unprotected sex, and free to own and to use guns, including military-type assault rifles. So live free in those ways and die prematurely. Steve has shown you the evidence. So I would ask you, is this really freedom? And if it is it worth what it costs in terms of our health, the health of our children, health of our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren? I don't think so.